This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Our guest today is Professor Richard Stith of Valparaiso University College of Law. He makes an incredible argument in his article in the current issue of First Things. He says this: legalized abortion was supposed to grant enormous freedom to women, but it has had the perverse result of freeing men and trapping women. Professor Stith, you make the point about choice being really forced as the great moral issue here. But how do you extend that to other issues as well? It seems to me that the direction of this culture is moving not only in the question of the sanctity of life at its beginning, but on many other issues to make choice the determinative issue.
Well, the same thing is happening with the end of life, too. People are being given choice through voluntary euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, which really amounts to the same thing. And the thing that happens, this is part of a general theory that I'm writing up. The effect of choice changes the object of choice, which something which has inherent value, is meant to be respected and cherished, to something that you can balance the costs and benefits of, and you know, maybe decide it's really not worth that much. And so this applies at the beginning of life and at the end of life. If grandmother insists on living on in her miserable condition, well, she must somehow prefer to be miserable. We don't need to help her. You know, if she wanted a way out, she could commit suicide. And frankly, we not only do we not need to help her, but we ought to blame her because, after all, she's using up the kids' college money.
Well, the argument I think is coming, Professor, and you're headed right there. I think it's just as likely that in what you so intelligently lay out as the scenario between men and women on the issue of abortion, where a man says, I'm not going to take responsibility for this child. You have the opportunity to free yourself of this child. Therefore, if you have it, it's yours. Professor, I can see a lot of scenarios where, like it or not, an awful lot of elderly people are going to think that they really don't have much of a choice, because if they do continue to live, if they do continue to use up these resources, they run the risk of impoverishing their family, exhausting their family. I think the logic is just chillingly familiar.
Well, and as long as we can't get back to this idea that we're stewards of life instead of owners of life, that they're going to be, that even they won't even be able to think of a way out. That the problem is that the fact of choice tells us that no absolutes are really involved, because if there really were absolutes involved, we wouldn't give people choice. So life, abortion or a suicide appear to just be matters of personal preference. And if a mother chooses to give birth, or grandmother chooses to live on, even though that burdens the father or burdens the grandkids, well, then she's blamed, and she seems to be being selfish, and she dies being resented. So it really destroys human solidarity in the most intimate, in among our most intimate familial relations, this turning of stewardship over life into a choice of life and death.
Professor, some years ago, an inside article was done about how the pro-abortion movement changed its presentation to the public and adopted this idea of choice as central. And so they renamed themselves the pro-choice movement. And instead of speaking of a woman's right to abortion, they spoke of a woman's right to choose. And some people, even at the time, recognized that it's exactly as you say. The sanctity of life cannot be an absolute now, because if it were an absolute, there would be no available choice. We don't give people the choice to murder. We don't give the people a choice to embezzle. So when it comes down now to the moral status of the unborn, to use the word choice, it really devalues the sanctity and dignity of every single human life.
It certainly does. I mean, especially for the people in the American public in general, who are take their standards primarily from the law, you would have to be very much, a kind of a Christian sectarianism, separated from the world, in order to have a different kind of standard and not be affected by that.
Professor, one question directed to you, just in terms of your expertise as a professor of law, this elevation of the category of choice to this kind of moral imperative. Is there really any precedent for this in the legal history of humanity?
No, society, the legal system, the political system works, one begins with the human community, and we try to serve the human community. The human community is not a choice. It's the starting point. And so to turn and make the human community, who is going to be a member of our community, who should be eliminated, into a matter of choice, destroys all coherent political and legal theory from the ground up.
Indeed it does. It destroys all morality, I think, as you extend that argument further. Dr. Richard Stith is professor of law at Valparaiso University School of Law, the author of this very important article published in the current issue of First Things. You can find his article by going to the website there for First Things. Article's entitled Her Choice, Her Problem, How Abortion Empowers Men. You can also go to my website at albertmiller.com and find my article published this morning, The Hidden Reality of Abortion, and you can find links to Professor Stith's article there. It has been a great honor to have Professor Stith as my guest today. And this has been the kind of conversation that hopefully will open some eyes and perhaps some hearts, some minds to rethinking the entire logic of abortion as it is presented in the public square. Professor Stith paid us the honor of coming on the program today. And Professor Stith, I especially want to thank you for delaying your birthday celebration today for your wife, Rosemarie. We wish her a very happy birthday, and I thank you today for coming on the program.
Well, I don't deserve thanks. I was going to say no, that going to the beach with my wife takes priority, and she said, no, the babies and the women who are hurt take priority. You go on that radio show. So.
Well, please thank her for an entire radio audience, and I would do so right now. And that is just a great testimony in itself, and I thank you so much. God bless you both.
Thank you. God bless you.
You know, this topic, just in terms of the sanctity of human life as the most important issue of abortion, reveals that when we think about this in terms of speaking in the public square, there are arguments that have to do with the way that that those who are proponents of abortion presented their case that really need to be confronted. I mean, the reality is that it isn't as if they were making an argument and the pro-life side was making an argument and they basically won the argument. Their own argument is a self-defeating argument when you take it on its own terms. Professor Richard Stith has really made that clear in his article. I asked him the question, he thought that this could change the way that we look at the question in the public square. You have to hope so and pray so. This is the kind of article that could be a game changer, the kind of argument that could open some minds. And I'll tell you, given the response I have had just today from readers of these articles, I've had women say to me, that's my story. Don't tell me that abortion empowered women. This is one woman who knows better. We'll be back with final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mueller, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. Today, we're going to have a very interesting discussion about this particular issue. Here it is. When abortion on demand became legalized in 1973, those who promoted it really touted it as a way of liberating women, and especially liberating women from the demands of men. It turns out that the reverse has been the case, that in the actual state of affairs, abortion has had the effect of abandoning many women because the men who are the fathers of their children say, well, if you're going to have this baby, it's all up to you. You could have an abortion. So this baby's your choice. It's now your responsibility in toto. Now, abortion itself is a grave moral evil. It is the wanton taking of an innocent human life. But when there is an evil of this calculated kind of level of importance. So when there is a tragedy of this magnitude, it never stands alone. It always has, by its tentacles, by its outlaying issues, by its connections, other tragedies. And it turns out that one of the associated tragedies of abortion is the effect that it has had, not just upon the unborn children, but on the women, the moms as well. And we're going to be talking about that today. A superb guest we have on today, Dr. Richard Stith. He has written a fascinating article. He's professor of law at Valparaiso University School of Law. And his argument is just so compelling. And he makes it so clearly. It's one of those conversations you will not want to miss, coming up shortly on the Albert Mueller Program. First, to review some issues in the news, we're going to be looking forward to a conversation tomorrow about what comes Wednesday. Wednesday is International Blasphemy Day, and it's been scheduled as such. The date, September the 30th, looks back to that date in the year 2005 when cartoons were published depicting the Prophet Muhammad's face in a Danish newspaper. And the explosion worldwide, well, it's still memorable now 4 years later. Riots in the streets of many of the cities in the Muslim world, and self-censorship then followed on the part of the Western press. We're going to be talking today about International Blasphemy Day and what Christians should think about it. Now, let me suggest that I think the most important thing we should learn from this is that the knowledge of God is so deeply implanted within us. Romans 1 makes that clear, that these who would schedule an International Blasphemy Day are, in an unintended way, actually bearing witness to the existence of God. And we're going to be talking about what blasphemy is tomorrow. We're going to be talking about what this day is all about. We're going to be talking about how Christians should respond to it. It is a great opportunity because there's going to be a lot of media coverage. You're going to see a lot of it, I think, in terms of the newspapers and the television and the radio. We need to talk about why it matters and how we should think about it. That's upcoming tomorrow. But in the meantime, just realize that at least some of our neighbors are going to be celebrating International Blasphemy Day on Wednesday. I don't think it's going to be a large number, but they're going to be pretty media connected. They're going to be pretty well connected in the society, and we're going to be hearing about it. Speaking of hearing about it, perhaps you've heard about the trend of Christian couples who are sharing email accounts online. And as the Associated Press reports on this, an increasing number of Christian couples are figuring out that a solitary existence online is an opportunity for sin. And even as the internet has become such a massive technology for the transfer of information, for communication, for social networking, for business and commerce, even as it has come with a great opportunity for gospel witness and for conveying vast amounts of information at virtually warp speed, it has also become an opportunity for sin. And in a particular way, when you just think about the plague of internet pornography, you see one dimension of that sin, but also in social networking and in email. Well, there is the opportunity of developing some surreptitious relationships that may appear more innocent when they begin, but end up being hardly innocent at all. It becomes an opportunity for grave injury to a marriage, and of course even then to adultery and to divorce and all that follows. The Associated Press is reporting that couples with joint accounts often come to this conclusion because they realize having independent accounts is really unhealthy. Groups like Focus on the Family have been urging husbands and wives to share one email address, but that's not presented as the only way that husbands and wives may deal with this in a way that protects both. I want to come back and say I think this is a very clever idea, a very healthy idea, and especially when you're not having to do business by email, it's a good way to protect each other. And I get an increasing number of emails from couples, and it'll say, like, Jim and Jackie, or with a last name, or, you know, it'll be Robert and Debbie. And then you see a last name. And that makes a lot of sense. I'm kind of heartwarmed when I see that. I think for others, the appropriate thing is not so much sharing the email address as sharing access. And here's a word of warning. If you're in a marriage where your husband or your wife is hiding an email account from you, that's a problem. And you should know that right up front. It's a problem. It's a problem whether there are any troubling, tragic, problematic emails in the account or not. And as we are married to each other, we should have full access to our online lives as well as to our offline lives in what they used to call the real world. So the reality is that what goes on in the electronic world, the digital world, on the web, Web 2.0 or whatever, that's all too real, morally speaking. And I think these kind of very helpful protective acts and understandings taken within a marriage can be extremely important. So, as the Associated Press finds this kind of a trend line worthy of their news coverage, I think we ought to list it as a trend line of moral importance for us all to consider. And whether it's sharing an email account, that may be a very healthy, viable option for you if you're a married couple, or giving full access, and that means with password and all the rest to email accounts. That's another way to deal with it. But hiding a life online is incompatible with the integrity of Christian marriage, and I think that needs to be made clear. By the way, one person quoted in this article said, you know, this just really sounds kind of suspicious. You know, couples should not do this because they're suspicious. Folks, we do not live in a world in which sin is so distant from us that this kind of access is based in suspicion. We ought to have the suspicion. We know we ought to have the absolute confidence that we need to be accountable to each other in marriage, and we need to take protections for each other in marriage. And we should suspect, if we're going to be suspicious, that someone that doesn't want that kind of access and that kind of protection must want something different. You know, one of the things that I remember from my boyhood and childhood is that there would be stories time and time again of war criminals who were arrested, Nazis in particular. They had fled to Brazil. They had fled to Argentina. Some of them were still in Germany. Some of them were scattered throughout Europe. Some of them had come to the United States, and recurrently there were arrests. Fewer and fewer now, and time is the simple reason why. The progression of years from World War II to the present means that there are fewer and fewer of these suspected war criminals now living, but they are still out there. Some of them are still out there. And you may be interested to know that there is still an Office of Special Investigations in the Justice Department of the United States where these war criminals are being sought out and cases are being built against them. Very, very interesting. Eli Rosenbaum has been the chief Nazi war criminal hunter for the United States government now since he joined as an intern in the Justice Department in 1979, has been involved in this, and since 1995, he's been its chief. Mr. Rosenbaum says that at present, this is a surprising number to me, but it's morally important. At present, about 30 people in the United States are suspected of having a Nazi past and are under investigation. 30. Now, consider how those numbers are now minuscule compared to where it was, say, in 1946, 47, into the 1950s. But now, more than half a century later, the numbers are thinning. So you might ask, why would the United States government still continue to operate such an office? Why would we continue to pay such a prosecutor? Why would we continue to build such cases? I think the answer given by this particular prosecutor, Eli Rosenbaum, is exactly right. He says this: I think there's a particular value in showing would-be perpetrators that if one dares to perpetrate such crimes, there will be a chance that he or she will be pursued for the rest of his or her life to locations thousands of miles from the locations of their crimes. I think it's exactly right. You know, those who would commit such crimes should know that there are prosecutors who represent the righteousness of the rule of law who will pursue them to the ends of the earth so long as they are alive. You know, folks, when you see that, that's a testimony to the human quest for justice. There is within us something that cries out for justice. Looking at the horror, looking at the murderous brutality and unspeakable inhumanity of the Holocaust, something within us cries out of the necessity of justice. And yet, as right as it is that we have this office, and as right as it is that this prosecutor should go after these war criminals, in the end of the day, many will get away. And that is why we must be reminded time and time again that as we yearn for justice, our hearts are really yearning for a final justice that only a sovereign God, in his holiness and in his justice, can bring about. War criminal or just common ordinary sinner, the day of judgment's coming. We'll be back to talk about why abortion has harmed women on the Albert Mueller Program.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. We're discussing a fascinating article that appears in the current issue of First Things, which is one of those journals that is must reading for the intelligent Christian. And in every issue, there's some very thoughtful pieces. But the one that caught my attention most of all in this current issue is by Professor Richard Stith, who's professor of law at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And he wrote an article entitled "Her Choice, Her Problem: How Abortion Empowers Men." Here's the line you really need to hear. Legalized abortion was supposed to grant enormous freedom to women, but it has had the perverse result of freeing men and trapping women. That perverse result is what leads to this conversation, and Professor Richard Stith is on the phone with me now from Valparaiso, Indiana. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very pleased and honored to be here with you.
I thought your article was seminal in so many ways, and the best and most effective argument you make is that there has been this perverse result of abortion. Even as we're not speaking of the most important issue of abortion, which is the sanctity of human life, the argument made by feminists has been that abortion is not only a good for women, but that it's necessary to level the playing field for women. You're suggesting that it has had the opposite effect.
Yes, I purposely left out any discussion of the sanctity of life to make it clear. I'm arguing purely about harm to women. And I think the important thing about there are many statistics out there that show this harm or that harm, and I think we all know that depending on how you ask the question, you can come up with almost any statistical result. The key thing about my article was to show that this is not a matter of an empirical question. This is a matter of the inner logic of choice. What has happened with the abortion choice is that sex no longer causes birth. Sex leads only to choice, and choice causes birth. I mean, we can hypothetically imagine, for example, that we were biologically different than we are, and that in order for fertilization to take place, let's say a woman had to lie down for 20 hours after having sex. Well, then it would be clear to us that having sex doesn't cause birth. The woman deciding to lie down for 20 hours is what causes birth. Well, that's exactly what's happened artificially, not naturally, artificially by the abortion option, so that fellows just say, this is all just a free-for-all. This is fun, and it's up to the woman later on to decide whether or not she wants to have a baby.
Professor, several years ago, a book came out entitled The Tentative Pregnancy, which is a very prophetic title dealing with the reality of the reproductive revolution. Now, nowadays, being pregnant does not mean you have a baby, or even that you're necessarily likely to have a baby. It means that, as you said, you face a choice. And the woman is the one who is burdened with this choice. And as you make very clear in your article, it's often not the kind of choice that feminists present it to be. Here you have a woman and a man who have sex. If she becomes pregnant, the man effectively, in most cases, pressures her to have an abortion. He's no longer under a social obligation to marry her and to take responsibility for this child. Now he says, if you don't have an abortion, this child is simply your responsibility.
Well, that's the way it seems to him morally, because, you see, she's left off the hook. The law says having sex doesn't mean you have to be a mother. And he feels, well, gosh, then why should having sex mean you have to be a father? I should get off the hook, too. And now our law still requires paternity support. But there's the moral basis for that, the feeling that that's fair, has disappeared. The fellas feel that why shouldn't they be as free of children as women are? So that without that moral basis, it's very hard to get the compliance to help women out.
You know, Professor, one of the interesting things that you put in your article, you cite Catherine MacKinnon, who is way on the left as a legal theorist, but it's fascinating how she almost reaches around to some common ground with conservatives on not only the issue of abortion, but also the issue of pornography. But on the issue of abortion, she early on, as a feminist, saw that the logic of abortion, in her words, would facilitate women's heterosexual availability.
That's absolutely right. She is an independent thinker. So many people in all different ideological camps tend to kind of just go along with whatever the local conventional wisdom is. But she's an independent thinker, and she saw how this harms women. And it's especially – I actually got into this article following up on her thinking. I was thinking about the third world. There's so many pro-abortion human rights activists who are trying to foist abortion as a human right throughout the whole world, even though they admit that in many of these countries, for example, in Latin America, because of machismo, it's the males who make all the decisions for women. So in a situation where the males are making the decisions, the right to have an abortion is just giving men the power to force women to get rid of the kids, and they can just exploit them more efficiently.
Indeed, so, to quote Catherine MacKinnon from your very article where you quote her here, in other words, under conditions of gender inequality, abortion does not liberate women. It frees male sexual aggression.
Exactly. But then I began thinking about that more, and I decided really – even if you have gender equality, which we don't fully have, but even in a country like ours, which approaches more closely gender equality, there still is this sense that it's her choice, and therefore it's her decision, it's her problem. She is ultimately the one responsible. So he can be as free as he wants with regard to sex, and then just if she decides to, he puts pressure on her to have the abortion. But even if she chooses to have the child, that must be that she prefers that. So she doesn't, you know, if she's getting her preference, why should he help out? It's kind of like, you know, she must think she can handle the problems, you know, otherwise she'd choose abortion. So there's this sense of letting him off the hook because, you know, she has an easy way out. If she doesn't take that, well, that must be her. That's her choice. And if she then tries to say he should continue to help out or the law says, that seems unfair. And the fellow feels like blaming her. You know, why didn't you take the easy way out? There's a kind of a resentfulness that begins parenthood rather than a joint solidarity around a new child.
Professor Stith, I have received just today, after publishing my article this morning, an incredible number of contacts, emails, letters, messages from women who have said, that is my story. I am the woman in that article. I did become pregnant, and I was put under enormous pressure, basically coerced by the man to have an abortion. And there is just such grief and harm they recognize. Why is it that the feminists will not see it?
Well, I think they don't want to, you know, they're afraid once you admit there's anything wrong with abortion, people will start seeing everything wrong with abortion. So it has to be presented as something perfect in order to keep it away from scrutiny, I think.
Well, you're so right about that. You know, that's why, for instance, American feminists will not even condemn sex selection abortions when it's the gender of the female that is most often selected for abortion.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, going back to points you made earlier about people writing in, I've given this talk to college audiences of young women and of college teachers many times. And they're always flabbergasted. They say, basically, you know, how could anyone disagree? You've told what life is like. This is the way it is on campus.
When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Professor Richard Stith of Valparaiso University. We're going to go back to 1973 when the United States Supreme Court handed down the decision, Roe v. Wade. I'm going to ask Professor Stith how it is that those very smart people wearing those robes on that the nation's highest court failed to see what is now so evident to those who have eyes to see. We want you to join the conversation. Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast, and with listeners around the world, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. My guest today, Professor Richard Stith, has written a fascinating article in the journal First Things about how abortion actually empowers men rather than women, turning the logic of feminism on its head. You can find his article by going to the journal First Things, and you can get there very quickly by going to my article published today at albertmueller.com, and you'll find links there to Professor Stith's outstanding article at First Things. Professor Stith, just before going to the break, I asked this question, and I want to come back to you now. When you go back to 1973, the United States Supreme Court hands down the infamous decision, Roe v. Wade. Do you think that the majority of the justices on the court at that time saw this as empowering men? They appeared, from the very logic of the Blackmun opinion, to think that they were empowering women.
You know, the real fact of the matter is they paid no attention to what they were doing. They were making the most momentous sort of decision one can make, deciding who belongs to the human community, and they thought it was a minor matter of health or sex or something like this, and they just paid no attention. That Blackmun's papers that came out in 2005 show very clearly that neither he nor any of the other justices in the majority thought that they were doing anything more than allowing for abortion in extreme extremely desperate medical situation. They thought that the abortions were always going to be done by doctors who, as a matter of medical ethics, would, of course, never consider an abortion unless some very serious health problem, medical problem, were involved. They did not anticipate the assembly line kind of thing that we see in abortion clinics. Now, it seems obvious to us now, but I truly believe it. And the best place to look for that, the best summary of that, is in the Los Angeles Times, September 14th, 2005. There's an article by David G. Savage entitled "Roe Ruling More Than Its Author Intended." And that kind of summarizes in a nice quotable source what I've just said, that they really had no idea what they were doing.
Professor, I want to follow this logic for just a moment and go back to Roe v. Wade. When that decision was handed down, and we now know, even from the statements of the late Justice Blackmun himself, that they basically made up that legal argument because the culture at the time seemed to be pressing the argument that this right of abortion, as they styled it, was absolutely necessary to liberate women. As you even look at the structure of that argument, does it make sense to you now?
Well, it doesn't really, but, you know, I think we, you know, if you look carefully at Roe v. Wade, that argument is not there. Now, Blackmun did become, once people credited him with being a feminist liberator, he took pride in that later on. But if you read the decision carefully, there's no notion of liberating women or women's rights. It's the rights of the doctor to do what they think is best, unimpeded by sort of dumb politicians. And it's Blackmun adulates doctors in the opinion, not women. And he thought that doctors were going to be strict, as I said before.
Yeah, you find that mostly in the amicus briefs, which
yes.
Were filed by all kinds of organizations, where
that's right.
It seems to me that the prevailing argument is this society has to recognize that women have this right. Otherwise, women are going to be relegated to a second-class status for the rest of their lives. You are arguing that in terms of the sexual dynamic, the relationship between men and women, what the decision effectively did was to relegate them to a second-class sexual status.
Exactly. Yes, right. Right. It made them the sole responsible person and therefore the sole person to be blamed for having an unwanted child.
Now, when you look at this decision now, let me ask you, just in terms of your role as professor of law, in terms of a legislative or judicial remedy for abortion now, do you think that the argument that you so persuasively make in your article could have any legal traction in terms of convincing persons of the ultimate effect of abortion on demand?
Well, I do think so. I think that that probably the major reason why abortion is continuing now is because the wives and daughters and others that the Supreme Court comes in contact with say that it helps us in our careers. And if one can show that it's actually harmful to women overall, I think this would change the legal logic and change the psychological dynamics.
I think it's a very important argument. When we come back, I'm going to ask Professor Stith about the morality of choice, a morality that has inherent limitations that are unseen by many but are of fundamental importance. To join the conversation, give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I genuinely hope that this kind of argument can help to change some minds and to reframe the entire debate so that if they want to talk about what's good for women, we're ready to talk about that. We want to talk about that. To be pro-life is to be pro-women, but not in the sense of individual autonomy and not in the sense of bowing down to this false idol of choice as it is so often presented in the public square. You know, the political shift from pro-abortion to pro-choice, just changing that nomenclature, is pretty effective in the public square. But when you think about what is implied, it's almost even worse, because it implies that human life is worth so little in the womb that it's just a matter of choice as to whether it's to be respected or destroyed, accepted or killed. It is also very reassuring to me to know that there in the law schools of this country, there are professors like Richard Stith, who are teaching the future attorneys and lawyers, legislators and jurists of America. Folks, in the opening, I spoke about this article in the New York Times by Laurie Goodstein concerning the prosperity gospel, this meeting, the Southwest Believers Convention that was held. And I spoke about the limitations of prosperity theology. It's a false gospel. And there is simply no doubt that it's theologically and biblically wrong. It promises what the Bible does not promise. It rips out of context the promises that are found in Scripture. And the reason I want to return to here at the end is because I'm afraid there are people who look at prosperity theology and say, you know, I wish it were true. I wish it were true that if I just prayed the right way, gave the right way, acted in the right way, the Lord would bless me with material abundance, with airplanes and yachts and cruises and diamond rings and all the rest. And health, of course, as so often what is promised, just in terms of kind of a word faith theology, is both health and wealth. The reality is that the true gospel, it doesn't promise less. It promises infinitely more. And the assured promises of God in Christ are for our salvation in this life and for the eternity yet to come. The reality is that the gospel Lord Jesus Christ says that we may have to forsake all things in this life in order to know the fullness of joy in the life to come. We will have all things beyond our imagination. The Scripture uses incredible metaphors and pictures to demonstrate for us the riches of what it means to be in the presence of God. But in the presence of God, we will not be there experiencing a prosperity theology about material abundance, but rather worshiping the one true and living God. In the meantime, some of the most faithful do not have much. Some of the most faithful believers go to bed at night hungry. I pray that the Lord will give them all that they need for this life, but I'm absolutely confident the Lord has given them all they need for the life to come. That's real prosperity. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.